Green blessings and welcome. This is Susan Weed, the voice of the Wise Woman Tradition, bringing you the Wise Woman Way radio show on Women's Radio. Join me as together we reweave the healing cloak of the ancients, helping you to reclaim your health and well-being through personal empowerment, the Wise Woman Way. Green blessings from Susan Weed.
We are sisters on a journey, singing now as one, remembering the ancient ways, the women and the wisdom, the women and the wisdom.
Green blessings, everyone. Thank you for joining me here again at Pat Lynch's Women's Radio. We are so excited about our guest today, and I think you will be too. Her name is Hearth Moon Rising, and she loves exploring the multidimensional stories of animals and trees. Have you seen her book? It's called Invoking Animal Magic. And it's a guide which takes an experiential and historical approach to understanding the animal powers, the powers of the furred, feathered, and scaled beings that share this planet with us. Hearth Moon Rising is a Dianic priestess and a priestess in the Fellowship of Isis. She has taught magic for over 20 years, and she's also a licensed outdoor guide who lives in the Adirondack Mountains of upstate New York. Welcome to the show, Hearth Moon Rising.
Hi.
I'm so glad you could be here with us today.
Yes, I'm happy to be here.
Good. So when you're talking about animal magic, gosh, I would guess that the first thing that kind of jumps into people's minds is some image of people ritually murdering chickens.
Oh, I hadn't even thought about that.
Well, I think that that's what's most associated with animal and magic, right?
Well, I guess so. Historically, even in the Euro-pagan traditions, there has been animal sacrifice. That's been an important part of it. Not certainly not the only thing. Now, I'm not talking about animal sacrifice. Animal sacrifice isn't, you know, it's just one part of the historical tradition, and my traditions that I have that I'm initiated in, we don't do that. So my book does not talk about animal sacrifice at all.
Well, as Dianic priestesses, and I'm also a Dianic priestess, we understand that sacrifice was simply a kind of second-class way to get menstrual blood.
Well, that was one of the that was one of the reasons for doing it.
And since we have our own menstrual blood, we don't need to do any sacrifices.
Right. We don't need sacrifice to get blood. That is true. But you know, we use animal energy in a lot of ways without using the actual animal. And in fact, in this book, I don't really even talk much about using things like feathers or teeth or animal horns or pieces of the animal itself. I talk more about using the energy of the animal, connecting with the animal.
So what do you mean by the energy of the animal?
Well, I mean connecting with the spirit of the animal, bringing the animal into your magic and your life in spirit form, or in actual interaction with an animal.
You know, it brings to mind a story. Perhaps you've heard this story. It's a Native American story that one of my teachers shared with me. There was a person walking along a path in the desert southwest, and there was an injured rattlesnake there. And this person picked up the injured rattlesnake and took it home and nursed it back to health. And when the rattlesnake got healthy, it bit the person.
Oh, uh-huh.
And the person said, "My gosh, why'd you do that?" And the rattlesnake said, "Because I'm a rattlesnake." So I often find, I don't know about you, that when people say they're connecting with the energy of the animal, they're connecting with their kind of romantic, idealized version of what the energy of the animal might be, but not, I'm a rattlesnake, I'm biting you.
Well, I think that animals are very multidimensional, just like people. And certainly the danger of the animal is one aspect of it.
I'm not even really talking so much about the danger. I'm talking about people's inability to really understand animal energy because they don't experience it except with perhaps companion animals.
Well, that is actually one of the reasons I strongly encourage people to spend time outside interacting with animals and, you know, get some less theoretical ideas.
Most everybody has access at least to squirrels, eh?
Well, they do. And, you know, I say animal friends, and, you know, animals are our friends, but we can have a very conflicting and contentious relationships with friends sometimes, and squirrels are one. You know, squirrels get into our houses and hibernate there and chew up wires, and squirrels can be very challenging.
They are indeed, right.
And actually, when I in one of the webinars that I'm going to be doing later this year, we're going to talk about what I call animal rivals, which are the manifestation of animals as mice in our house and deer that eat our gardens. I'm sure you're familiar with that.
Well, keeping a herd of dairy goats, the deer are a minor nuisance compared to the goats.
Really? I can believe that.
I often say that goat keepers can keep gardens, but gardeners should never have goats.
Well, I think that people's romantic notions of an animal are also relevant.
That's important, yes.
I do think that in using animal magic, we also use our experience and our ideas about an animal, and that is definitely relevant, especially when we are trying to interpret a guided meditation where an animal appears, an unusual interaction with an animal in the wild. Certainly our own associations with the animal, cultural and personal, are very important.
Yes, I certainly find that so. A six-year-old boy of my acquaintance was at an outdoor wedding party and was running around barefoot and thought that he kind of smacked his ankle into like a briar, you know, raspberry or blackberry. And, you know, about an hour later, when his entire foot and leg was swollen up to the knee, and his mom looked at it, they realized he'd been bitten by a poisonous snake. And it was quite a scene there at the party. There was somebody at the party who was insisting on calling an ambulance, and his mom did not want to do that at all. And actually had to leave by the back door to get her kid out and away from the hospital and well-meaning do-gooders. And she said the only mistake she made was elevating the foot, which she definitely should not have done because that allowed the venom to move up into the upper part of the leg.
Oh, right.
Right. So you don't want to ever elevate. Anyhow, after this was all done, you know, and he was better again, I talked to him because I knew him personally, and I said, "You've been chosen by the snake people. You are now a member of the snake tribe or the snake community or the snake clan, and you need to go outside and spend the night outside entirely by yourself." He was 9 years old, so he's certainly capable of doing that. I said, "To let them know that you have agreed to be part of their clan."
Okay.
And so we took a situation in which he might have been left with some kind of fear of snakes and turned it into a situation where he became a protector of snakes.
Okay. Yeah.
And I think that that's some of what you're getting at, too, yes?
Right. Definitely. It's funny with the snake. A lot of people have fears of snakes. It's one of the most common phobias. And I think that when there is a fear of an animal that goes beyond rational fear, obviously if I see a rattlesnake, I'm going to give it a wide berth and not go near it in striking range. But I mean phobias, extreme fear where you can't get near any snake. I think that one of the ways of healing those fears is to look at the associations that the animal has in your life, and you know, whatever those are. It might be that you associate the snake with evil, as some Bible passages talk about it as being a tempter of evil. So working through issues that the snake brings up that are fearful are a way of working through phobias about snakes.
And in your book, do you give exercises or ideas about how to do this? I mean, if somebody's truly afraid of snakes. I had somebody who broke off a relationship with me because I showed her a garter snake.
That has happened to me too, actually. Although it wasn't a garter snake, it was a rattlesnake. So.
I mean, a garter snake. It's not like I threw it at her or shoved it in her face. I just said, hey, look, there's a garter snake right there. And that was it. She wanted nothing further to do with me.
Uh-huh. Well, I do not in the book talk about how to get over snake phobias. That does not come up. In fact, I start out the book talking about an interaction that I had with rattlesnake that was very, very interesting and transformative.
Could you share a little bit of that with us?
Okay. I was living in this underground house in the Sonora Desert, and it was kind of like a dugout house, and everything could come in. Stray cats could come into my house, and certainly mice, which I didn't like at all in the house, and there were scorpions underneath the mattress.
Under your mattress, there was a nest of scorpions?
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
Rather dangerous.
They never bit me.
Okay.
Not at all. I left them alone, and they left me alone.
Hooray.
But I also had snakes come and live with me. And I was
going to say, you must have been a very quiet sleeper, or it must have been a very thick mattress.
Well, one of the things that I would hear in the night, actually, that was present a lot was the sound of snakes slithering.
Mm-hmm.
Because I had my bed up on a platform, a dirt platform, a mattress on top of the dirt, and the snakes would just slither around my mattress through the night. And a snake slithering on dirt, it's a very distinct sound, and it's a very soothing sound.
Yes.
And when in ancient Greece, in the hospitals, they used to put snakes in people's rooms, and people would sleep in rooms with snakes slithering around to get the healing energy from the snakes. So I was happy that the snakes were around because,
fewer mice.
Yeah, there were mice, and I with hantavirus and all the other diseases that mice can carry, I didn't want mice living in my house. I love mice, but not living with me.
Mice and rats were the only animals that Juliette de Berkeley Levy did not like at all. I would even go so far as to say she hated them.
Oh, really?
I've heard her say that God made a mistake when she let mice and rats onto the ark.
Oh, really? Oh, well, actually, I love mice. I love mice, and I think that mice are can be very healing.
But just animals. Not in one's house.
No, you don't want them in your house. So I was happy about the snakes, but one day a rattlesnake moved in, and I was not happy about that because I was afraid I'd step on the rattlesnake, roll over it in my sleep.
Right, right.
You know? So I was very, very stupid at this point. You know, I didn't really know anything. I went over to a neighbor who had a snake catcher. And a snake catcher is a piece of PVC pipe, and it has rope going through it and a noose at the end of the rope, and at the end of the pipe. And snakes will move into a noose. They like to move into holes. And so the snake will naturally put its head into the noose, and then you pull the noose tight, and you have the snake secure a safe distance from you because the pipe is between you, and that way you can catch the snake and release it somewhere else without harming the snake. So I went to her because I knew she had a snake catcher, and I brought the snake catcher into the house, and the house is too small to use the snake catcher. So, the snake is on the windowsill, and I'm like a few feet away from it, definitely in striking range. And I don't know why she said this, but she said, give it a tap on the head. So,
your friend.
Yeah, my friend did. So I gave it a little tap on the head.
With the snake catcher.
Yeah, with the PVC pipe, yeah.
Okay.
And it pulled its head back and blinked, and she said, hit it again. So I hit it again. I mean, this is the classic story of the boy jumping off the bridge because somebody told him to do something. So I hit it again, and she told me to hit it a third time, and I did. And the third time I tapped it on the head, it slithered away for that day, and then it moved back in the house. But it was a kind of a transformative experience, like the boy with the snake bite. Although I did not get bitten, I really connected with the snake in that moment. And I'm not recommending that anybody do that. That was the stupidest thing that anybody's ever told me to do, let alone that I did. It's those sorts of unusual experiences that we have with animals, whatever they are, that allow us to really connect on a deep level with the animal.
And what happens when we connect on a deep level with the animal?
We get the wisdom of the animal. We get as people, we don't have all the answers. We think that we do, but we really don't. And animals, a snake especially, lives under the ground, and they understand the earth, and they understand what it means to go deep inside and deep into the womb of the earth mother. And they also understand the energies of the sun, because they bask outside in the sun, they absorb the sun's rays, so they also have things to tell us about the sun. And they also have things to tell us about beauty. Most weaving goddesses and textile goddesses are either snake, sun, or spider goddesses, because the beautiful patterns of the snake have inspired women to create beautiful works of art with textiles.
So true.
Yeah, and in fact, the most famous pattern of the American quilt is what? The rattlesnake design.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Interesting. I believe that this is what's being called an interactive book, that there's a meditation that goes along with the book, an audio meditation, not just a written one. Is that true?
Yes, that is. And it's on the Internet, and you can go to the Internet and download it and burn it to a CD or
so would
or
we go to invokinganimalmagic.com?
Right, invokinganimalmagic.com.
Invokinganimalmagic.com.
And the meditation is a meditation to meet the bear mother.
Ooh.
So and it's worth going to. It's a very professional production. I went to a studio to have it done. So it's very good. And Martha Gallagher, who is a well-known harpist, is doing the music for it.
Oh, very, very beautiful. What could someone expect if they download this meditation and engage in it?
Well, I recommend that you read the book and use the meditation along with the book.
Along with the book.
Yeah, because I think that you really need to be careful with guided meditation. And in the book, I outline some of the things to do to keep it safe. And the biggest thing about keeping a meditation like that safe is that you don't want any animals, any physical animals, around you while while you leave your body for meditation.
Uh-huh.
Because if you're going into a deep trance, you don't want something to disturb you and startle you. And that happened to me one time. I was in a very deep trance, and my cat jumped on me while I was out, and it was extremely traumatic to be touched at that moment.
Oh.
And I still don't know why the cat did that. She's a very well-behaved cat.
Ness, in many cultures, I have read stories about people becoming animals, or animals pretending to become people.
Well, I have not experienced animals becoming people at all. That is an experience I haven't had. That's a new one for me. I certainly have become an animal during ritual.
Uh-huh.
That's a very common thing.
It is, especially in the European tradition, the idea of shape-shifting. And the witch is familiar that the witch has an animal that she shapeshifts into. And then we kind of hit the high point of this on Dracula, right?
Who
can turn into what, a bat,
he
a wolf?
He turns into a bat, yeah.
Or a wolf.
Or
I think there might even be a third animal, that Dracula. So we really bring that. But it's more from the Occidental cultures that we find that animals turn into people and then marry people.
In a lot of myths, yes. Animals do marry people.
Right?
Yeah.
And they take on a human form and marry people. And then, of course, there's all kinds of strange things that happen because of that.
Uh-huh.
I'm remembering especially a story from Japan about a fox that becomes a woman and seduces people.
Oh.
For her animal ends, not for human ends, because animals think differently than people. And to me, this is part of the animal magic, is being able to shift my brain into a different way of thinking.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Do you find that true, too?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. We only have a little portion of the wisdom that's out there, and trees and animals help us to understand the world better. If you look at a little mouse, its world is very small in many ways, but it sees what's down there on the ground, on the surface of the ground and underneath. And so we learn a lot by really thinking about an animal, meditating on an animal.
So the information in your book, Invoking Animal Magic, you said that it's a historical approach. Does that mean that you're talking about what people historically have associated with these animals?
Or are you giving us
your own experience?
Well, both. I think that it's important when you have an experience with an animal to look at your experience and to look at the associations in your culture. You have a dream about a lion, and in Western culture, especially in English culture, lion is courage, the lion-hearted. So you draw in those cultural and personal associations. And then you need, I think it's very important to move out of your personal frame of reference. And this is where I think I differ from a lot of other people who also teach about guided meditation and shamanic journeying. I see an interaction with an animal as as an invitation to go a little deeper and learn a little more. And that doesn't mean that you negate your own experience or your own culture, but you go a little deeper, and it's an invitation to learn more. And so I think that learning some of the historical associations that we may have forgotten is very important.
So how far back do you go when we're talking history?
Well, to the Ice Age. Our earliest religious art is animals.
Yes.
And
I'm thinking of the lion goddess that was discovered in a cave in Germany, dated to at least 30,000 years ago.
Very much. And even when we find goddesses, there tends to be an animal association with them. You know, there will be an animal companion pictured with the goddess, or she'll be holding the horn of a bull. So, you know, you go back in early religious art, and animals are all over the place. So, I go back as far as we can.
As far as they've left anything for us. And in addition to the book, Invoking Animal Magic, by Hearth Moon Rising, and you can find that at www.invokinganimalmagic.com, do you also teach?
Yes, I do teach, and I'm looking to start some webinars and branch out a little more. I'm one of these witches who lives in the forest, so I have my own students here who are learning from me. But I'm wanting to reach out, and that's one of the reasons I wrote the book, is to reach out to an audience that may not have the opportunities that I have to just go out in the wilderness on a normal day. I'm very fortunate that I can do that, but not everybody can, and not everybody needs to. You know, I think it's important to get out in nature once in a while, but that doesn't mean that you have to do that to worship animals or to use animal magic. So I'm hoping that through some of my other classes and through the book, I'll be able to help more people to do that.
And if people are interested in engaging with you in your teaching, where could they look for more information about that, Hearth Moon Rising?
They can go to Invoking Animal Magic. I'll have a link to my school there. I'll have classes up there. I'll have the webinars up there and upcoming classes, so they can find out about it there.
Well, we've come to the last couple of minutes of our show, and I'm wondering if you wanted to share with us an animal that's particularly good for healing.
Oh, okay. I would share the toad, actually, because it's not one that people are familiar with as a healing animal. But the toad has been used to regulate women's fertility for antibacterial properties. During the plague, people would tie dead toads under their armpits, or even put them in their pants for the lymph nodes. And I'm not saying, I have to interject, I'm not telling people to do that, but that's the history. And a lot of magic actually developed around toads because using the toad itself was difficult. It's very difficult and messy to use the qualities of the toad itself. So there's a lot of magic around using toad energy, because if you know that a toad has antibacterial properties on its skin, and and you have an infectious disease, through magic you can call in the energy of the toad to help you with healing.
How wonderful, the toad as the emblem of healing. So you might want to, this spring, think about getting a little toad house in your garden. They are really quite friendly creatures. This is Susan Weed here at Pat Lynch's Women's Radio, and you've been listening to me talking to Earth Moon Rising, a woman who is making change and offering you a way to make change by changing how you view the world by connecting to animals. Find her at invokinganimalmagic.com. Thank you so much for being with us today, Earth Moon Rising.
Oh, thank you, Susan.
Green blessings, everybody, till we meet again.
This is Susan Weed, the voice of the Wise Woman Tradition, bringing you the Wise Woman Way radio show on Women's Radio. Green blessings from Susan Weed.
We are sisters on a journey.